is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. We appreciate you taking time today to come join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with that esteemed cohort live, if you are so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. And if you have some observations you would like to share about the show as it's going on, or if there are some questions you would like for us to address to our guest, you can go ahead and put it right there in the chat room. We'll be monitoring it as the show goes forward, and we'll be happy to bring your ideas into the conversation. And if you have to take off halfway through the show and want to catch up on what you missed, or if there's some previous shows that you want to catch up on, if you haven't already, go ahead and go over to iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, whatever podcast aggregator you prefer to use, and subscribe to the podcast right there. That way, when you're doing your commute or whatever strikes your fancy, Midrats will be waiting for you at your convenience. And for today's show, let's go ahead and dive into it. Here we are. We've got a new year, a new decade, as of last week, a new president, and we figured this would be a good time to look at where we stand for both a maritime strategy and also a national strategy. Where are we in trying to find something we can have some type of agreement on, and what directions is the international climate perhaps pushing us one way or another? And our guest today for the full hour is a returning guest and one of the best folks we could have to dig into the subject a bit. That's James R. Holmes, Ph.D. He is the J.C. Wiley Chair of Maritime Strategy at the Naval War College. James, welcome back to Midrats.
Hey, gentlemen, thanks for having me on once again.
Really appreciate you taking some time this afternoon to join us. And just to kind of kick things off as a scene setter, I was thinking prior to today's show, back to when, you know, you and I were little midshipmen. I'm sure you got it. I believe you went to Vanderbilt. Our ROTC unit had a box come in the mail that had that beautiful little magazine, Maritime Strategy, that, you know, really was, I think, caught that what we didn't know at the time, the last few scenes of the Cold War, but there had been years where people have been talking about national strategy, the maritime component, where it came in, what equipment and ideas needed to be done, and we're trying to communicate that to the general public. And after the end of the Cold War, we've all gone through a few phases, and cautiously trying to be optimistic, but I know how dangerous that can be. I've been thinking recently that as the last two decades with the global war on terrorism, for lack of a better phrase, brush wars we've been involved with in Asia, with the clearly from the background relief rising challenge of China on all the various domains of national power, and just the fact that there's a lot of flux in the system, that there might be an opportunity now to really work towards some type of general consensus on a national strategy to help steer us through what most people agree is going to be a very challenging decade. So just rolling that way for you, James, where do you see the stage of the conversation to building and understanding what our national strategy should be? And is there room for some optimism?
Yeah, thanks. I think that's a great way to open. when you said something about being optimistic, you reminded me of the old joke. I think it came from George Will or one of the news columnists sometime past. He said it's good to be a pessimist because you're either right or you're pleasantly surprised. And that's generally I tend to be a pretty upbeat person, but that's sort of the attitude I try to take when I talk about this stuff. I think it's much safer to be more pessimistic in that way. Yeah, I mean, if you're pleasantly surprised, all the better. If not, you're prepared for the worst. So that's generally the outlook I bring. Yeah, I don't do predictions. I mean, we're having NFL Sunday games today, it's not exactly fitting, but it always reminds me of the old joke. Well, maybe it wasn't a joke. Yogi Berra, you can never tell what, but the old baseball manager Yogi Berra said that prediction is tough, especially about the future. One of his great weird statements that floats around on the internet. I think that with regard to optimism about maritime strike, I think there actually is some reason to be hopeful. To dig back, maybe just to take a macro view of this and reach back deep into U.S. history. In fact, if anybody wants to look this up, I'm a contributing editor for a new startup called 1945. And you can either search on 1945 the number, or we actually spell it out 19 the numbers and then 45 spelled out, just kind of our kitschy way. It's an outlet that is basically set up to do what we're trying to do today on this program, which is to examine the causes and the consequences of constant change. I mean, think about the daily news. I know that from the moment I get up until the moment I go to sleep, I feel like I'm encountering constant change. That's the sort of insight that we're bringing to it. But in any event, for my piece today, which I called the beautiful stability of U.S. foreign policy, I went back and I noticed, and in fact, I used a couple of engineering metaphors or maritime metaphors. I called it. I think there's actually historical ballast that keeps the United States from swinging too widely in foreign policy and strategy. Or you could think of it as a flywheel if you want to take it into the engineering context or a governor or whatever the case may be. There are certain policies that have commanded support for long periods of time across most of the political spectrum, including left and right, in your more minor political parties, whatever the case may be. And I go through just briefly some of the Monroe Doctrine. I mean, I think the Monroe Doctrine for at least a century in U.S. foreign policy really as the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy, namely that European empires were barred from coming back and trying to reconquer bits of Latin America from which they had been kicked out, or retake them over by proxy rule. And this is a defensive doctrine that whereby the United States tried to keep Europeans from getting naval bases, military bases in the Western Hemisphere once they were gone. Again, a policy that remains in effect for a century. That's a lot of durability. That's something that you can really count on to damp down wild swings in policy and strategy. In fact, I would actually say the Monroe Doctrine probably is still sort of unofficially enforced to this day, even though it was disavowed almost a century ago. I mean, think about it. It's just a reflex for us. I think Americans, we think of ourselves as the guarantor of first resort for hemispheric security. That's the basic insight that underlay that policy. You don't hear it called out by name too much, but you do see that impulse to act as the leader of the American hemisphere. To hold off threats from the Eastern Hemisphere, and I just go through a few other ones. I think the notion that when we talk about the rimlands, trying to keep the rimlands of East Asia and Western Pacific fragmented so that you don't have a hostile power or coalition or alliance take over and reach out into the Western Hemisphere and do us harm. This is something that goes back at least to the days of Teddy Roosevelt and Alfred Thayer Mahan. They didn't give it the name, but that's basically what they were talking about. This is an idea that was updated throughout the 20th century, and ultimately helped give rise to the forward presence that we take for granted to this day, network of military and naval bases all over the globe. These are our ways of managing those rimlands, sort of in an offensive way, in order to keep threats from taking shape and then reaching out again and doing us harm in our own hemisphere. And then, of course, the one that we all remember, or most of us remember from our lifetimes, including you and me, I think we're very close to being contemporaries. Containment. I mean, containment was articulated in a George Kennan's long telegram to the State Department in the late 40s, and remained a consensus strategy and policy for the United States until 1991, when the Soviet Union fell. So I would offer those three or four examples I trotted out as examples of something in U.S. history that tends to keep us from, again, being all over the map and flipping about wildly and taking different approaches. One thing I mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. One thing he said that really struck with me in one of his late, not State of the Union addresses, but his message to Congress. He said a wise radicalism and a wise conservatism go hand in hand. The radicalism making sure that change comes about, and the conservatism making sure that no change occurs unless it's in the right direction. I think he's on to something about U.S. politics domestically, but especially in foreign policy. So that's sort of the 30,000 foot view. Does maritime strategy fall into it? I think it does. I certainly hope it does, since we now have a new maritime strategy just since last month, and since it came out really at the 11th hour of the Trump administration. But a lot of the ideas that go into it, and if people have not read that yet, it's certainly well worth your time. The Tri-Service Maritime Strategy, and the actual title is Advantage at Sea. But a lot of the ideas that go into that, you started seeing come about certainly during the Obama years. But you can make the case that some of these ideas have been floating around ever since the Cold War, and have sort of congealed into a consensus strategy. Think about who inaugurated the pivot to Asia, President Obama, or actually Secretary of State Clinton, when she wrote her famous article for foreign policy in late 2011, which was subsequently translated into policy at the Pentagon in early 2012. The 2015 Maritime Security Strategy says we are all about guarding freedom of the seas. It's right there on page one of that document. You know, and on and on. Even some of the weapon systems that we're now seeing starting to mature, all of these also came about in previous administrations and were adopted by the Trump people. And I think that there's a good chance that they will be the principles, I think, will be adopted. How the principles are executed, I think, will be where we should watch. So it's possible to have a consensus set of principles and then have different administrations, different individual leaders put those into practice differently. So, for example, I would expect the shipbuilding plan that floated around late last year, Battle Force 2045. I would venture to guess that's probably a non-starter. It might have been a non-starter even under the Trump administration because of the budget question. How could we afford such a force? But certainly, I think that the new administration will try to put its stamp on all of these things. So I think you will certainly see some changes. You'll see some changes in the language used to talk about maritime strategy. But I think the basics. I think there's a good chance the basics will last, and I certainly hope that is the case.
I want to plug your a book that you wrote called A Brief Guide to Maritime Strategy. I was laughing when I was reading the introduction or your preface to it, where you're talking about when you were a young midshipman at Vanderbilt that we didn't get taught any of that stuff. And as when you were a junior officer, you didn't worry about strategy much. You were too busy doing other stuff. This book that is short, easy reading. Let me commend it to people. Has a really good introduction to strategic thinking that everybody, young officers, civilians, I think you even said congressional aides, people like that should read to get a grip on what naval maritime strategy is and how it fits mostly into the national strategy. But let's talk a little bit about some aspects of what you wrote in that book. I mean, you've talked about Rimland, you've talked about containment. As we have shifted from to this large East Asian country that's got some serious problems trying to get out of its the niche it's in because of the island chains around it, where do you see us going with our maritime strategy? If it's not the one that as you said just came out a couple of weeks ago or months ago.
Yeah, well, again, I hope the general approach will prevail, even if it goes by a different name or if the execution is modified in different ways. Well, just to recap what you're talking about, the strategy is basically about certainly the Marine Corps. I think the Marines have led the effort since General Berger became commandant in mid-19. To try to disaggregate our efforts into more lighter, cheaper ships that we can afford, and then yet still pack a punch, so that we can fight on and around islands, and particularly the first island chain. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt always told Americans to pull out their atlas and look at your map when you're thinking about strategy. You look at that island chain, all of the islands from Japan on south through Taiwan, the Philippines, Indonesia. These are all either American allies, friends, or at least partners in the case of Indonesia to a certain extent. That translates into the ability to mount basically a barrier, sometimes I call it a great wall at sea against Chinese access into the Western Pacific. If we can plug up those straits and the skies overhead with these small units of Marines armed with anti-ship missiles of all types, operating with unmanned craft, the fleet, the Air Force, everybody else. If we can mount that sort of barrier, that's a huge deterrent, because China depends. If we depend on China on access to rim lines that are very far from the United States, far from North America, China has to worry about access from the time an aircraft takes off in China or the time a ship casts off all lines in Beijing or not Beijing but Shanghai or whatever seaport that you choose to talk about. That's a real strategic advantage for the United States, and I think that's really the core idea that underlies the maritime strategy. So this is why we talk about distributing the fleet into more and more smaller and spread out ships, aircraft, and all these sorts of things. So that I think the logic of this is something that's, you know, I think it's something that's taken hold. You started hearing these ideas. I've been rattling on about this for, and my friend Toshi Yoshihara have been rattling on for about a decade. You started seeing people sign on to that during the Obama years, during the late Obama years, and then especially during the Trump administration. And again, I hope the momentum will keep going. As far as thanks for the plug for the book, I'd like to reiterate that just real quickly, just because I suspect that a lot of the target audience would be among our audience here. It's aimed at junior officers, midshipmen, duly commissioned officers. I tried to keep it short and straightforward and fairly simple, simply because I understand that people such as yourselves, you're either college students and you're totally busy, or you're out there trying to learn to fly airplanes or steam engineering plants or whatever. You have no time to read this stuff, and yet it behooves us as a force to have an educated officer corps, senior enlisted corps, right from the beginning of your career. So this is a book that will be on the CNO's reading list whenever that drops, which should be any time now. Midshipman, anybody can borrow an ebook copy of that and make use of it. So I start with the big ideas, and I try to help readers make sense as junior officers, senior enlisted, of what they're doing on a daily basis. What does it mean when we go to do an exercise? Why do I have to take up my liberty time giving ship tours in foreign ports? Whatever the case may be, there are important diplomatic functions and political functions that go along with that sort of stuff. As indeed, I know, Sally, I think you and I are always railing about the appearance of our ships. That actually has an important function diplomatically as well, beyond the fact that we just need to take care of our stuff so that it works when we need it to. If we always used to mock the Soviet Navy in the late Cold War for being rusty, for looking slovenly, for not operating particularly professionally at sea. We don't want to fall into those pitfalls, and there are strategic reasons and political reasons why. So why don't I stop there? But yeah, I hope that maritime strategy is an enduring strain in U.S. thinking, and I guess that'll give us a measuring stick to judge how the new leadership is doing.
I thank my co-host for bringing up your book, because there's actually a point from there that I wanted to talk about, and now would be a great time because we're just talking about it. And before the show today, I grabbed the intro. And I said, I just want to at least read the intro just to touch base with it. And the intro to your book, again, for those who are listening, it's a brief guide to maritime strategy. It came out, I think, November of last year, paperback, Kindle. You know, go to your local Amazon and pick up a copy. But what I liked in it, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to maybe drop a few names, because one thing that I've always been a little frustrated, especially when you're talking outside the maritime circles, which you always want to do, when people think about strategy, they think about Clausewitz, Jomini, Sun Tzu. Yeah, those guys, they come from highly militarized or feudal nations that had just the opposite of what we had. They had military structures that had a nation attached to them, whereas we're a republic that happens to have a military. That sounds nuanced, but it means something. And in the intro, you said something that I found really neat, and I'll quote you here for a second. Quote, consult the endnotes. They are designed to help newcomers to maritime strategy to start branching out, unquote. I thought that was such great advice, especially for, you know, the junior officers or midshipmen out there. Just don't read what James Holmes has or thinks what's important. What prompted him to think in those notes and those other readers can branch them out into some really interesting areas? Inside, you know, some of those end notes, what are some of those thinkers that come to mind that you really would like for people to pay attention to that end note and follow that breadcrumb?
Yeah, so thanks for highlighting that. Yeah, I would say, I mean, I think I don't have a copy of it in front of me, but I think the first line is this book is a note. It's a missive to my former self. You know, so when I was a junior officer, looked around and started wondering why I was doing all the things that some of which seemed kind of mysterious on sea duty and on shore duty to an extent as well. So that's the perspective I bring to it. You know, I mean, just from a macro perspective, I think you make an important point, and it's one that I wholeheartedly agree with. You have to decide what you want to be in your intellectual capital. I mean, I would say not only should you not confine your study of strategy to the Clausewitzes and like you said, the people from very different societies since ancient China, all of them. It doesn't even, but to learn and to grow, it doesn't even necessarily have to be dry and dusty tomes about strategy at all. I mean, those things oftentimes come to feel academic, they're extremely important. We put a lot of emphasis on them, but don't scorn wisdom wherever you find it. If you like biographies, for example, I'm reading Ben Franklin's biography right now. I think I'm always jotting down notes in the margins, and sometimes I'll actually type them up at the end if I want to keep them in my capital for a long period of time. For example, it was a very amusing story about intellectual openness from Franklin. He founded a debating society, sort of a small group of guys in Philadelphia in the 1720s. They called it it looks like it ought to be junta. It looks like the word junta, except it ends with an O, which I suppose it means it's probably pronounced junto. But in any event, the amusing part and the part that really makes me like those guys, and especially Franklin, is they would actually fine for the participants to a debate if their opinions were too strong, if they were absolutely certain of the truth, and if they just went around smacking each other's arguments down and basically implying that their debating partner had no claim on the truth, they would be fined. And as it turned out, Franklin later unsuccessfully proposed such a rule for the Continental Congress when that started being a thing in the 1770s. But I thought that was just great. We are always trying to figure out how to make ourselves, but also make our institutions more freewheeling, more free thinking. Whatever we can do to create the culture that rewards that sort of experimentation, I think it will make us better over time. So that's a long way of saying don't shun biographies, don't shun literature of all times. I love science fiction and literature. I'll oftentimes use a metaphor from for example Battlestar Galactica back in 2005. The very first episode is all about a cyber attack that basically decomposes, basically breaks up the colonial fleet, the human fleet, so that the enemy Cylons can take down that fleet one by one because all the connections, networks, and whatnot among the elements of that fleet are broken. That's right. That's very similar to what our Chinese friends, the PLA, think about. They talk about systems destruction warfare. If your adversary fights as a system and he's coming at you, if you can break the links that bind that system together, at that point you can take down the nodes in that system one by one. So right there. So again, pop culture, even sports, all of these sorts of things are sources of wisdom. So do take your education seriously and shape it for yourselves. Now, as far as to bring it back to the specific question, the big names are the big names that you encounter. Clausewitz actually doesn't make it in too much. I mention him, I give him his due, especially right in the opener. But I treat it as a very maritime intensive books. So there's a heaping helping of Mahan's ideas, mostly his geopolitical ideas, his ideas about maritime strategy being all about access. He's very specific about the purpose of maritime strategy in rank order, descending order. It's about commerce, diplomacy, and military power in that order. Military power you need to maintain a diplomatic presence overseas in places that you would like to trade, and the diplomatic presence is there to make commerce work, to make sure that your businesses can do business. We can all become wealthy and generate wealth, part of which can go back to fund the Navy to protect trade. That's the virtuous cycle that Mahan sees. So he talks about geography. He talks extensively about the Caribbean Sea and the Gulf of Mexico in particular, because he knows that the Panama Canal will be opening, which it did late in his life. He died in late 1914. So he comes across a lot. He gives us the big ideas to what I call the logic of strategy. When you start moving down towards the operational level, that's where you shade over and you find a lot of Sir Julian Corbett, Mahan's contemporary, who wrote he was on Jackie Fisher's Inner Circle and wrote a wonderful book called Some Principles of Maritime Strategy, which really explains how to put big ideas about strategy into effect, denying command of the sea, fighting for command of the sea, winning it and then exploiting command of the sea, how to design a fleet, all of these sorts of things that he really brings to the table. So actually, these guys struck sparks. They didn't always get along. They said they sort of sniped at each other once in a while, but I actually see them as good companions, with Mahan covering the big ideas and Corbett doing a great job explaining how to put them into effect. J.C. Wiley, the namesake for my chair of maritime strategy, wrote a wonderful book back in the 1960s, riffing on his experience. He was the XO on the Fletcher at the Naval Battle of Guadalcanal. He was literally the first CIC, Combat Information Center, and he took these ideas and he parlayed them into a nice short book called Military Strategy, in which he makes some important ideas. So I guess that's probably the main parts of the pantheon that come to mind. We'll run into Mao Zedong a little bit, just because he was all about active defense, an idea that Corbett also talks about. So there's some other bit players around the edges, but those would be the pantheon for this particular book.
Yeah, let's talk a little about thinking outside the box, and I think you said some what was the word you used? Freewheeling thinking. I was looking at your 1945 website, and one of the things you did was talk about T.X. Hams, whatever he pronounced his last name.
Yeah, Hams.
Article on the Navy needing more firepower, and you mentioned these some things that many of us have discussed in other environments, but the payloads, not platforms, taking merchant ships, turning them into missile carriers, putting them out to sea, disguising them somehow. Walk through some of the strategies that would be lower cost than building more $8 billion, $12 billion aircraft carriers, but would disperse the lethality, as the saying goes, and talk about that a little bit, how that would feed into a strategy of, if you want to call it containment for China, but at least providing them with some things of concern to them.
Yeah, actually, Liam, I'm not going to redefine your question, but you said something late on. I think it's important to the Chinese, and I think they sincerely believe this. They think that we are still trying to contain them. I made the case that containment was a policy with staying power. They think it is still enforced, and that we have brought it to bear against China. I think the way to think about that is to try to look at containment as a policy and containment as a strategy. As a policy, I don't think the metaphor actually fits. I mean, China today is radically different from the Soviet Union in the 1940s and 50s when containment took shape. We have a lot of interaction with it, which we did not with the Soviet Union. I mean, commercial and political interaction, and so on and so forth. And so in that sense, and plus, I don't think it doesn't appear to me that the Chinese are trying to export a hostile ideology, which they hope will sweep the globe. Even though they're Marxists and Leninists and so forth, they don't seem to be. Determined to go on the march in the sense that the Soviet Union was. So as a policy, I don't think containment quite fits. Now, down as a strategy and down towards the operational level, I think containment, I think it actually is an apt metaphor. And in fact, we are talking about going back to our playbook from the early Cold War when we used the island chain to try to constrain and fetter communist military movement up and down through the Sea of Japan and in the China Seas, as well as east-west into the Western Pacific. It's an old we're essentially putting new wine into old bottles in that sense. So when you hear that term containment come up, ask some questions, because I think it gets used kind of cavalierly and kind of sloppily a lot of times. Okay, you mentioned TX Hands. He's a wonderful guy, a retired Marine colonel, and he's always coming up with off the wall ideas. About 2 weeks ago, I guess he came up with an idea that we should buy low cost cargo ships. We can outfit them with anti-ship missiles, with rudimentary combat systems, and so forth. And then basically just have them blend in. With commercial traffic. This would basically be. He didn't actually use the term. I think I might have when I commented on it. It would basically be sort of an American version of gray zone operations that the Chinese have deployed to good effect in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, using not overtly military implements as implements of national power, of maritime strategy in this case. You can do that. If you think about it, if we got into a scrap with the Chinese, that would really complicate their efforts to ferret out these missiles. He called them missile merchantmen. It's really kind of hard to identify those things among all the maritime traffic in East Asia or wherever the fight might be happening. So this gives us a way to sort of hide in plain sight and defy the Chinese to come and fight us. If they make a mistake and they hit an innocent merchantman, guess who looks like the bad guy? They do. And at that point, we get the propaganda value out of that. So this was one idea, and he trotted out some pretty impressive numbers. Basically, so he said we can get scores of these things for the cost of one Ford class aircraft carrier. He didn't overtly say we should cancel a carrier and pour it into this, but that was sort of the measuring stick that he offered. So you can buy them at low cost. The missiles are relatively cheap, and you can go with a small crew, a small Navy crew, and probably be a mixed maritime merchant marine and Navy crew. He wasn't very specific about that. So that's one way to try to get more hulls out there, more firepower out there. And also put our adversaries back on their heels just by being deceptive. They're all about deception. We should take a page out of their book as well. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. The other big name I would call attention to, who's been talking about this for a long time. Well, he's not talking about it anymore because he passed on a little over a year ago. Was Captain Wayne Hughes, the author of the book Fleet Tactics. All right. Actually, I think they should just put classic into the title of that book, because you can't say fleet tactics without calling it his classic fleet tactics, which goes all the way back to when we were midshipmen. I still drag around my old dog year copy from 1985 in the office. Wayne's been talking about adding what Corbett would call a large flotilla, a lot of little ships that you can super empower. With sea mines and torpedoes back in the days of Corbett, or with anti-ship missiles, mines, whatever the case may be today, perhaps as motherships for UAVs or the various types of unmanned vehicles. He estimated that we can add a large flotilla of single mission ships to the fleet at very low cost. He's not talking about dismantling the large surface combatant contingent or all that kind of stuff, but he did talk about rebalancing within the fleet to favor that sort of flotilla that's optimal for operating in and around littoral waters, especially around islands, hostile seaports, whatever the case may be. So those are the two ideas that really resonate with me. I kind of wish TX had talked about had written this article before I published this book, because then I would have given him some play. So that's part of the ferment that's out there on maritime strategy and force design right now.
Yeah, a lot of what we think about for maritime strategy and what's at sea, I mean, it's based upon some assumptions that, like all assumptions, especially ones that have been around for a while, we just assume it's part of the environment, that it's always there. But you know, geography is a firm fact, but what you do with it is really a human construct. And when we look at I think you've used this phrase quite often, the maritime common, the concept and assumption that we have, it's not a force of nature. It's something that if you correct me if I'm wrong, but if you want to give 51% credit, it's the Dutch and the English created this system that everybody else plied into. And for the last two decades, our best minds have been focused on other things. While the Chinese have had the luxury, at least in my paranoid thoughts, they've had the luxury to really soak and think hard about the directions they want to go to. And they've done tremendous things at sea and with being able to forward deploy a naval presence. And they've done some things that are, as our Commonwealth friends might say, is not quite cricket. When the assumptions that we have about the maritime common, is this something that you can see that China will just adopt and run with and co-opt to their own needs? Or do you see some indications that they may want to create a new framework and a new set of assumptions about how the maritime commons in the nations interact on it?
Yeah, that's a great, you packed a lot into that one. Let me sort of take it in the order that you posed it. First of all, that's a big philosophical point when you talk about assumptions. I mean, assumptions are something that we regard as self-evident. And that's if you're talking about a system of logic, these are things that we assume we hold to be self-evident, as the Declaration says, but that can be neither proved nor disproved within the system. So that sort of sets them outside. But I think we do have to revisit them once in a while, because sometimes we do assume things that can be disproved or proved within the system. Maybe overtaken by events, maybe overtaken by the rise of a new competitor, whatever the case may be. So I think it is wise periodically to revisit those just in case we are treating something that should not be a core assumption, something that is not permanent as an assumption. And I think this idea that the commons, the maritime commons, what Mahan calls the wide common, this maritime highway that all nations can use. I heard some really extreme versions of this idea, even in pretty recent years, especially from scholars, people who are not practicing seafarers. I was actually aghast. I came a bit more than a year or two ago. I heard somebody whom we've heard of say that maritime security is not only there, but it's self-enforcing. Nobody has to go out and police the sea. That is really kind of shocking. I don't think that's ever been true. The first navy in world history that we know of was founded. Thucydides tells us it was founded in the Aegean to squelch piracy in the Aegean. So right there. That's just kind of shocking. I think nobody should assume that the system will always be there, or that the body of ideas will always be there, or that new entrants rejuvenated Russia, we're now seeing that they're going to sign onto this way of thinking. Russia's done some things sort of similar to what China's been doing in the South China Sea. If you look at the Sea of Azov in the Black Sea, if you look at what it's doing along its northern frontier and so forth, I don't think these ideas are ones that are going to command wholehearted support. I think they have to be defended. Let me go into this idea about the Dutch and the English that you mentioned just previously, because I think it's actually fascinating. We have actually seen an old debate that we thought had been solved with the approval of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. The idea that no one owns the sea, that's a very Dutch idea, going all the way back to the legal scholar Hugo Grotius, the father of international law as we know it. He argued that Great Britain, which of course lies astride, or actually England in those days, England, the British Isles, which lie astride the sea lanes that connect the Netherlands to the North Sea and ultimately to the Atlantic Ocean, Britain was in the habit of insisting that those belonged to Britain. They had sovereignty over those waters. They set the rules governing what shipping could and could not do in the waters around the British Isles. This is an idea that was put forth as a rebuttal to Grotius's ideas about freedom of the sea. It was actually a pretty fast going thing back in those days. Today we would just tweet at each other, but it was several decades before Selden came back. But he said no, Britain owns the sea, and you can be sovereign over the sea. We thought we had had this debate over the course of the century since the 17th century when this debate took place. And it had been settled by international law, and yet you're now seeing potentially hostile great powers reopening this question simply because they can. How far does it go if China gets its way? And I think that's really the that's sort of where the rubber meets the road. I'm not completely willing to say that China necessarily wants to rewrite the rules of the system across the entire globe. It might. I mean, I guess we'll see possibly how well China fares building up its national power, its maritime power, and so forth. The power might actually drive what the aspirations Beijing puts into place. But I think they seem to date to be more concerned with the waters, obviously the waters that we're concerned about, the China Seas, and especially the Western Pacific in the Indian Ocean. These are where it seems like it wants to have a dominant say in what the rules are. Let me tell one quick anecdote that I find fascinating from European history, from Renaissance history, that I find very helpful and actually very interesting. There was a doctrine, sort of an unspoken doctrine among European powers, back when North America was first started to become a thing, when the Spanish and the English and everybody would constantly fight at sea, in the Caribbean Sea and the Gulf of Mexico. This was the idea of no peace beyond the line. The idea was that European kingdoms contiguous to each other, contiguous to one another in Europe, could be at peace in Europe, and yet the rules were different on the far side of the Atlantic. We could fight like cats and dogs at sea. You could have Sir Francis Drake and all those guys constantly preying on one another and so forth. It feels like there might be, and you might actually be able to even chart where that line was between China, between the waters that China really cares about and the waters in which it might play well with others. It might be along the Malay perimeter, which of course separates the Indian Ocean from the China Seas. It feels like China might do things differently in different parts of the world. So I think that old idea is a metric that we can use to judge what China wants, how likely it is to get it, and what the rest of the world might do about that. We certainly have the capacity to push back, and the harder China pushes on these things, I think that could be a self-defeating move for China. So a whole lot of actions and interactions and reactions that we're likely to see at sea. But again, I at least hold out some hope that China might be easier to live with elsewhere in the world than it is in its own backyard.
Well, speaking of pushing back, I've noticed that the new administration has already sent some ships on freedom of navigation operations through the Taiwan Strait. And that kind of ties into your recent, I guess in December, you had an article on your 1945 site about China seems ready to fight over Taiwan. A lot of what China's up to, I mean, they've said there's no medium between China and Taiwan anymore. There's a whole bunch of other stuff, but you know, they keep presenting the world with these fait accompli situations where we've already done it, and unless you're willing to fight about it, we're just going to, you know, we're going to just keep going the way we are. So the buildup of islands, the claiming of islands that are actually in other countries' territorial waters, I think, or at least been claimed by other countries. You know, let's talk a little bit about what China is up to and what they hope to gain by the way they are acting. If you know, they claim they're complying with international law, but it's clear that that's not the international law we know about. But I think you point out in your book that sometimes international law gets changed by the customs that have developed usage, basically, like a lot of other law.
Yeah, that's a great question. What do Chinese want? I think we started the latest edition of the Red Star of the Pacific book. I think I came up with that idea. We started doing it somewhere around Martin Luther King Day. So I said, China has a dream. China, Xi Jinping, General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, he calls his policy, and it almost sounds like it's too impoverished to call it a policy. I mean, it's a big idea of China. What does China need to do to fulfill its dream of national destiny, of greatness, basically? Well, I mean, some of that stuff in this, I think these help explain what China is doing in the waters and the skies around its edges. I mean, part of that dream is to get rid of what the Chinese constantly call the century of humiliation, memories of this long century from the late 1830s to the founding of the PRC in 1949, in which European empires and Japan, to the United States to a lesser extent, they basically had their way with China coming from the sea. At certain points, if it looked like China might actually be partitioned by Europeans into spheres of interest, which would basically become their own trading zones and lock other nations out. But anyway, for China, the leading power in Asia for many centuries, to be a plaything of outsiders is something that does not sit well with China. So that's a big part of it. It's just that psychological dimension. What do you have to do in practical terms to bring about those psychological gains? Well, one thing that China quite clearly wants to do is regain every inch of ground once ruled by dynastic China until that fell early in the early 20th century. The Taiwanese will argue about it, but China quite clearly considers China part of that territory. It also considers the South China Sea that, including the islands, and apparently the waters and skies. This all seems to be territory that China must recover to fulfill Xi's goal of China's dream. When we get down to the operational level, you mentioned the first island chain again, which is something that stares China in the face every day. They can't get away. They can't get their minds off this problem of access. How do you do it? Break the chain. Chinese strategists call the first island chain literally a metal chain. That's a metaphor that really resonates. It goes all the way back to Admiral Liu Huaqing, who commanded the PLA Navy in the 1980s, and I would describe it as the father of the PLA Navy as we know it today. He described it as a metal chain reaching from Japan through Taiwan and on south. Well, so Taiwan is at the midpoint of the chain. It's close to China. China regards that island as its own. I think that explains the value that they attach to it. The moral values that they attach to it, they're constantly promising that this status quo that we have now cannot last forever. I think that suggests that they are willing to invest major resources to recover that island, and however long it takes, basically to recover, make Taiwan part of China again. What do they have to do? What do they have to do with that? Well, that's where the anti-access, as we call it, strategy comes in. Fielding anti-ship missiles of all types, combat aircraft, obviously the PLA Navy, things that are able to strike way out to sea, not only to target U.S. forces and allied forces already in the theater, but also especially forces coming from Hawaii and the West Coast, to unify with those forces to make up a combined fighting force. I don't think they can hold us out of the theater entirely, but I do think that they think that they can slow us down enough and do enough damage that we either won't reach the combat theater in time to make a difference, or if we do, we'll be so weak that we can be defeated. Sort of the same idea that the Imperial Japanese had almost a century ago, into the Second World War, and I think that idea has gotten new life with China. But again, that phrase "China Dream" is really evocative. To go over, to, I think it's Xinhua, one of the major Chinese news sites. It actually maintains a China Dream page that you can, and it basically aggregates all different articles explaining what various facets of that is. The Olympics coming up in a couple of years, but that will obviously be a big part of it as it was in 2008. It's really an all-encompassing concept, and it's well worth your time if you surf in there and have a look.
And you and I are pretty close to the same age, and I'd feel bad if I didn't take the opportunity to have you here because of the timing of the show. But, you know, you and I were both JOs, during Operation Desert Storm that we're now going through the 30th anniversary of. And though it may seem slightly disconnected from our conversation, I don't think it is. And like me, because it took place in a formative part of your life, I know every few years you look back at it and think about it. But if three decades on in that very unique little part in time, when you look at it, are there some things from Desert Storm that are, if not lessons, thoughts or observations or things that we did that you think should be part of the formula that we use at looking at what we need to do this decade as we build and support our strategy?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, some of the big themes that really stand out to me would be obviously. There are certain legacies we're still grappling with to this day, 30 years later. And you probably remember. I remember we showed up in the Gulf, I believe, in late September of 1990, And we found that the Middle East force, it wasn't a fleet at all in those days. It was basically, if I remember right, seven frigate and destroyer types based at Bahrain. This notion that we always have to have an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf these days, at least one. That's something that is a product of Desert Storm, but especially of Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. This idea that we need to commit on the order of 10% of our carrier power, actually more than that when you factor in maintenance and whatnot, a big share of our carrier power to this basically secondary theater in our strategy. I think that's a baneful result of that era, and I think Desert Storm started the ball rolling in that direction. And I think we're still dealing with the momentum from that. There was a major debate in Washington about whether we would put any carriers in the Gulf. Ultimately, we did. We had a bunch of them, or the major surface combatants. So that debate was held back then, and I think the legacy is still with us. The other one would just be sort of the simple one. I mean, we talk about access denial all these times, using land power as sea power, as weapon systems can reach farther and farther out to sea with greater and greater precision. Sea power becomes more of a joint thing than it's ever been. Air forces can fly all over the Persian Gulf. They can reach well out into the Western Pacific from China and other nations. These are implements of sea power. It's been a beautiful thing to watch our fellow joint services actually take ownership of that idea. The U.S. Air Force started to consider itself its maritime role again. The Army talking about fighting on islands, and so on and so forth. So that idea of jointness, which we're always talking about, I think it is a real thing. And I guess the last one would just be sort of respect the adversary. Saddam's military was fairly backward, and yet he created a lot of trouble for us. I think you mentioned in one of your pieces not too long ago in the past, Princeton and Tripoli actually hitting very rudimentary sea mines off the Kuwaiti coast, doing damage to major warships with very primitive weapons. I remember being out on deck more than once and seeing things that looked like sea mines out of Gilligan's Island, you know, the big balls with spikes sticking out of them, floating down on the side of the ship. So I think as far as respecting the adversary, realizing that these fairly primitive weapons can come out and do us harm. That's an idea that we have to keep in mind, simply because our adversaries also studied the Desert Storm experience, took lessons out of that, including our Chinese friends, and have sought to put that to work, fashioning their own anti-access measures, which of course are backed up by a major world economy, all the technological expertise that a country like China can bring to bear. So I hope we didn't take the lesson out of that it was going to be easy in the future, because it's certainly not.
One of the lessons, I'm a little older than you do, Sal, but speaking as out of Desert Storm, one of the lessons we learned was that we didn't have enough sea lift. And I'm not sure we've maintained that lesson. And it also goes to one of Mahan's principles, which was to have a strong merchant marine. That justifies having a strong Navy. And we don't seem to have much of a merchant marine left that's worth much. These days, we've provided a lot of cover for Chinese and other countries' merchant marines. What about that? Is part of our national strategy lacking because we don't have the sea lift that we need?
I think the answer is yes. A couple of years ago, I became friends with the editor at The Hill, the newspaper down in Washington, which I regard as a pretty good paper, and started doing a little writing for them. But then the very first piece I did for them, probably in late 2019, if I remember right, maybe earlier that year, and I called it "Lose the Merchant Marine, Lose the War," and for that I actually did some. It's not actually easy to pin down the actual numbers between that are. Of merchant hulls that are scattered among several different organizations in Washington, but it appears that we have about as many people in our merchant marine, or as many vessels in our merchant marine fleet, as we lost during the first year of World War II to German submarine attacks, which is kind of a sobering thing if you're thinking about fighting across thousands upon thousands of miles in the Pacific. If our force is that lean. That we can't sustain, can't replenish our transport capability. Then yeah, I think we're in real trouble. So I would entirely agree with that. There's actually a book I just reviewed for the Naval Institute. It was a Naval Institute book I just reviewed that was published in the 1980s. Reviewed it for Northern Mariner up in Canada. And I think it's fantastic. It's nothing more than a bunch of oral histories from different protagonists in the Second World War in the Pacific. It's called The Pacific War Reconsidered. And I think it's one that that I would like to provide a copy to everybody in the maritime services if I could. Some of it's sort of standard battle stuff. I mean, Jimmy Thatch discusses how he developed his famous weave tactic for use at Midway. And that's all wonderful stuff. But the chapters to me that really stand out are about all the mundane stuff you have to do, the sort of non-combat stuff you have to do in order to make that fighting force go. For example, there's a chapter from a CB officer who was right here on the Narragansett Bay, got 2 weeks in late 1941 to assemble all the equipment and put to sea for the Pacific to build a base on Christmas Island to try to solidify that sea lane to Australia. I mean, that's just fantastic stuff. It's about maritime engineering. They go out and recruit people from Standard Oil, people who know about tank farms and so forth. There are chapters about beach preparation. There's a chapter about obviously the service squadrons. There's a chapter from the overseer and officer who oversaw a floating dry dock at you leave the anchorage and late in the war. It's actually kind of a fun one. He actually describes how apparently the skipper of the Iowa back then was a real cowboy. They kept telling him that they were bringing the Iowa into dry dock. That they kept telling him to slow down. He wouldn't slow down. He pulls right into the dry dock. Does a real cowboy move and backs down hard. Stops on a dime. Looks great, but then he disturbs the blocks underneath the ship, and they have to go back and reset those. But anyway, a lot of human flavor. But that's really the takeaway is those support functions are vital, and I think we have neglected them, which is probably why the Naval Institute saw fit to republish that at this time.
Of course, it's easy to say that we can control our own actions because often we can't, because sometimes it seems like we're not taking any action, but we are. But there's something we have even less control over, but significantly impacts what we're planning on doing, and that's the decisions that our allies and friends and friendly, neutral type of nations out there, things that they're doing, the decisions that they make can and should cause us to adjust and reassess what we're doing. And when you look specifically, west of Wake Island, what's going on in the Pacific Rim, are there some moves that other nations have made recently do you think are significant enough that they should be part of any type of adjustment or reassessment of what we think that we need to be aware of in the West?
Well, I mean, you make a big point that we're always harping on around here when we talk with our students, and that's that war, strategic competition, and war is an interactive process. It has sort of a mercurial sort of a slashing back and forth equality as each side makes moves and counter moves to try to impose its will on others, or at peacetime to try to impress everybody with who's stronger and who's weaker, and therefore gain political capital that way. So that idea of interaction is a perennial one, and I think it helps explain the sort of back and forth dynamic that you've seen between ourselves and China. China's been on a roll for a long time. I think we have started getting our house in order in some ways, at least. Certainly, when you dig down towards particular weapon systems, the SM-6, whatever the case may be, and so I would expect to see that sort of sloshing back and forth quality go on as long as this competition with China does. As far as other countries, I mean, not only look at the map, I mean, think about alliance relations. I mean, what is America's strategic position in the Western Pacific without alliances? We don't have one. If we can't operate from Japanese seaports and airfields and bases of all types, if our alliance system were to unravel, at that point we were in real trouble, simply because we could presumably still project power into the region, but it would be on a much less sustained and a much more sporadic and intermittent basis, simply because it's hard to sustain fleets and air forces out at sea that far from home. So I think job one for the new administration, and I think this was actually one thing that really drove me nuts, was the cavalier attitude out of the previous administration towards alliances. sort of publicly rebuking, especially that. I mean, think about the Koreans. Think about publicly demanding that they quintuple their contribution to our force presence in their country. I mean, that's it. If you want to have that sort of play that sort of bare knuckles politics, alliance politics, by all means do it, but do it in private. Don't put people on the spot, and above all, don't suggest that our commitments to our allies are not sacrosanct. Those should be, I mean, that should be central to our foreign policies to keep that alliance system going. So yeah, so it's Korea, Japan, all those nations are actors whom we have to try to bring into our strategic calculations. But yeah, we have to keep that strong. We really have to. The new administration really needs to think about what the status of Taiwan is going to be as well. Are we going to try to remain ambiguous towards Taiwan as we have for many years, or are we going to move towards much more formal relations as the Trump administration started to do? I was glad to say you guys actually mentioned a couple of good moves out of the administration in its early days vis-a-vis Taiwan, and I was actually glad to see those. So because I think alliance relations and friendship should not be ambiguous if you want to send signal to the bad guys that we're going to stand by our friends and allies.
Well, that's a really good place, James, to kind of ask you the standard closing questions, which involve what are you working on, what can we look forward to from you soon, and where can we find it?
Okay. I publish once a week, so you can find me over at the National Interest. That's my longstanding publishing home. Obviously, at 1945, which we've given a pretty good play here today. I'm not regular at the Hill, but once every month or two, I'll appear over there. So those are the small scale things that I can't try to keep a steady stream of those things. Excuse me, coming along. The next book will be. In fact, I just got done reading the proofs of it. That will be coming later this year. It's actually, I always wanted to write some philosophy, so I actually took a very philosophical look at the practice of strategy, and I'm describing. In fact, I riffed off of the old book Habits of Highly Effective People. I'm calling it Habits of Highly Effective Maritime Strategists. I go all the way back to Aristotle, who was basically the philosopher of habits. I come up through modern psychology and basically try to identify a slate of characteristics, of virtues, if you want to call them that, that I think strategists need to have to flourish in the military and the maritime environment. Had a really good time doing it. It sort of took me out of my comfort zone, and so hopefully that will fare well. The next one for a couple of years down the road. I haven't gotten quite started with this one yet, but it's going to be a companion to the Brief Guide to Maritime Strategy. Because I tried to keep that one so short, I did end up basically shortchanging a lot of things that I thought that junior officers didn't immediately need to know. But yeah, there's been a fair amount of call for me to talk about air forces as maritime services, armies, and so forth. So I'm going to call this one a brief guide to joint sea power and think of it as a companion volume to that. So I'm looking forward to that. I've wanted to do a little writing about air power for a long time and haven't done much. So this will be an opportunity to get into that.
Well, it's been a great hour. Really appreciate you taking time today, James. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And again, over on the Twitter feed and in the chat room, we got a link to 1945. That's 1945. And best of luck for you and your cohorts there and being part of the conversation. And I look forward to the next opportunity to talk to you.
Hey, thanks a lot.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Piccadilly, fair Pirates!